Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The pandemic had its way with public education in this country. Like so many other systems, the system of education that has been fully embedded in our culture for, you know, at least a century, but, you know, beginning well over 200 years ago and emerging over the course of those two centuries, was upended in 2020. After that, school districts across the country struggled with on-again, off-again quarantines that shuffled students between online and in-person learning with little to no notice. Technology helped, but it was far from adequate. And everything in from school provided breakfasts and lunches to recess, extracurriculars, and other important emotional and social facets were upended as well. The disruption was profound, but it enabled some to take a step back and reassess the system for what it is and whether it is sustainable going forward. Does it do its job? Former Ohio State Superintendent of Public Instruction Susan Zelman co-wrote a book on reimagining the American system of education. It's titled, appropriately, The Buying and Selling of American Education, Reimagining a System of Schools for All Children. Susan Zelman, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne, and thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Let's talk about the title of the book. It really gets to it, The Buying and Selling of American Education. Who's buying and who's selling?
Well, it's, you know, I want it to be provocative. And I wanted the book to be provocative because I think in being provocative, you raise a lot of challenges and questions and that we could come to better alternatives or solutions. But, you know, my feeling was that schools have been built around the needs of adults, not the needs of children. And in my introduction, I talk about the seven P's that they'll see in the book. And these are our professionals, our politicians, our partisans, our plurocrats who want to keep things the way they are, our parents, our publishers, and our producers of like new educational technology. And even I had vested interest in the system. So,
as a former superintendent.
As the former state superintendent. And, you know, now that I'm a grandmother and I have seven grandkids and saw what happened to them during the pandemic, plus it was the pandemic, I thought, okay, this is the time to write a book and to say, you know, even before the pandemic, we were not really doing well as a nation. Our NAEP scores were beginning to decline.
Which are NAEP scores?
NAEP is the National Assessment of Educational Progress. They survey all of our states to see how well our students are doing, particularly in math and science and English language arts. And even before the pandemic, our NAEP scores began to slip. And during the pandemic and afterwards, we saw incredible decline in our NAEP scores. And I think we could do better for our children. I mean, I'm a post-war baby, and I think, you know, our lives are relatively easy. But we have a moral responsibility to educate our kids in a world which we cannot even predict.
So the buying and selling is all wrapped up in those P words?
Right. It's like everybody. I mean, you know, we all have vested interests. You know, as a parent, I remember thinking I had a choice of choosing which school for one of my kids versus another. And I chose it because it was more convenient to me as a working mother, as opposed to where our kid might have gotten a better education. You know, that sort of thing.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is former Ohio Superintendent of Public Instruction, Susan Zelman. She is co-author of a new book. It's titled The Buying and Selling of American Education, Reimagining a System of Schools for All Children. If you have a question or comment this hour, I'd love to know what your fantasy is about how to change education in the state of Ohio. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org, because that's something that we're going to get into, is the role of everybody in this, you know, this education system that Susan Zelman and her co-author Margaret Sorensen envision. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Who did you write this book for?
Well, I wrote this book for a broad audience. I was an academic in the first part of my career, and when I went into state government, I quickly understood that people in the Massachusetts Department of Education, governors, policymakers, really didn't know about the history of American public education. And I always felt it's important when we want to bring about change to understand root causes and to see where we've been, what mistakes we might have made in the past, where we are in the present, and how we could use that that information to imagine a new future. So I wanted the general public to read it. I wanted parents to read it to see how schools really work. I wanted prospective educators to read it so they would know something about the history of American education, the sociology and politics of education.
What did the pandemic reveal about the system of education in the U.S.?
I think our system of education has always had incredible inequity. You know, we have what I would call the myth of the common school, that it didn't matter what holla you came from, but everybody came to one school and had access to high-quality education. Well, the system didn't historically work that way, and it still doesn't.
It never has,
and there is great gaps. And what the pandemic highlighted to me personally was that it really showed that our lowest performing students, our marginalized children and their families, were most impacted on that. And we need to do a better job. Now, I tell you, I have 7 grandkids, all the way from 18, 6 boys, and finally got my girl, 6 boys and 1 girl. My youngest is 9. She's my little girl, and she's a pistol. But, and they're, you know, very privileged kids, you know, in the scheme of life. And I think the impact, I saw as a grandmother, the impact that the pandemic had on them. And then I thought, oh, my God, you know, look at the poor kids who don't have the technology in the house, whose parents have to work.
Who don't know where they're getting breakfast.
Who don't know where they're getting breakfast. And I think our schools in Ohio did a wonderful job of trying to address those issues. But, you know, those disparities still exist. And quite frankly, I am so tired of what I call status quo educational reform. I have been at it for 55 years.
Like tweaking around the edges
and
never doing
it. Yeah, we're tweaking around the edges. And we have not really taken the time to say, what if we could start over? In a world of new emerging technologies, what can we envision and imagine? And then I read this book called Rebel Talent by a Harvard Business School professor named Gino Francisca. And she made a statement, which is really an old statement, I think, from the 1800s. If you want to make an omelet, you have to break a lot of eggs. And I think it's the time for us to break a lot of eggs and to reimagine and rethink what's possible.
Oh, I'm trying to think about what was the kind of the imagery. It seems like turning around the Titanic when you're getting ready to crash into the iceberg. How do you do that? How do you reverse engine? Not necessarily reverse engines, but change course when you're talking about something like the Titanic.
Well, I think what we have to do, both at the federal and the state level, is put more money into innovation and research and development. And, you know, Governor Kasich, because I also worked for him for a while, had the Straight A Fund. And I actually think the Straight A Fund helped a lot of districts prepare for the pandemic, because in fact they bought a lot of technology, they experimented with online learning, they experimented with workforce development projects and so forth. So I think that was good. But I think we need more of that. I mean, what I call for is a multi-sector partnership, governments, philanthropy, the business community coming together and having something like an X Prize for education, either nationally or within our state, and generate some enthusiasm. Bring all kinds of different people to the table. Use it as an idea to, again, think creatively, out of the box, and put together some pilots. And then what we could do is have a strong R&D operation. Don't kill the pilots right away if it's not working. But really see what can work, particularly with marginalized families and children.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've thought a lot about this, that, you know, education alone can't do it. You know, and we need to bring in the wisdom and the determination of marginalized peoples and families to work with us, to understand their existence, what they need, not to fix them, but to have, and not to be judgmental, but to have an asset-based approach.
How has the history, what does the history of education in this country tell us about why parents, marginalized people, all kinds, why they're not more involved?
Well, I think part of the thing, I mean, we have always had culture wars. This is nothing new.
Right.
But I think part of the issue is that we have not done a good enough job of training our educators, our superintendents, our teachers, our principals, to open the schoolhouse door, to become in some ways cultural anthropologists, to go out in their communities and to have the school be an open forum and to have constant communication. You know, many very good superintendents in our state do a great job in strategic planning. You know, they have coffees, they invite groups of parents in, and so forth. But then it stops. And this must be a continuous process. And it must be a continuous process because, particularly after pandemic, school administrators and teachers lost trust in the public. If you look
they
at the
lost
data,
trust or they the public lost trust in them.
I'm sorry, I'm
That's
dyslexic.
Okay. That's okay.
The public lost trust in them.
Okay.
And I follow the data from a public agenda starting in the 80s where, you know, people might not like public education in general, but they always loved their school. That's no longer the case.
Hmm.
And so I think this is really crucial. Otherwise, our schools become a political target and subject to manipulation. So I give a talk to different groups now about community-based leadership and how we must do that. And when I say open the schoolhouse door, and education alone can't do it, I mean connecting with their organizations, the churches, the health groups that they go to, people for support, and change our attitudes. You know, one of the things I learned when I was a beginning teacher in New York City, I was only actually 20 years old, and I came into the teacher's room, and it was Grace Dodge Vocational High School. And I said, oh, it feels so great to be back at Grace Dodge Vocational High School, which was right across the street from the Bronx Zoo. And so the teacher said to me, oh, you can't tell the Bronx Zoo and Grace Dodge Vocational High School. And I thought that was so demeaning.
They said what? They said
you can't tell the difference between Grace Dodge Vocational High School and the Bronx Zoo.
Wow.
And I was so shocked. I thought that was so demeaning.
Yeah.
And the reality was that they gave me to teach the seniors who were the age difference between the seniors and myself were maybe a year. And these are kids who came from very difficult situations. And I realized that they had better coping mechanisms than I did. They were incredibly intelligent and very capable. Plus, I remembered back to when I was in sixth grade in the New York City school system, and a boy from our class came in from Harlem named, named Ernest Gibbs. And ironically, because it was hard to find apartments, my parents, the first 9 years, lived in a housing project. And Ernest Gibbs had an apartment on our floor. And my mother said, be nice to him, walk to school with him, and so forth, which I did. And I really found him a great kid. And he ironically was in my class. And then he left my class. And I went to Mrs. Eisner and said, why is Ernest not in my class anymore? And she said, well, he came from Harlem, and schools in Harlem are not as good as PS 122. And I thought to myself, why not? And I think that incident gave me the passion, plus the comments of Grace Dodge, my colleagues at Grace Dodge Vocational High School, that really wanted me to go into education and ultimately leave my brilliant academic career, wasn't so brilliant, and go into state government work.
That is Susan Zelman. She's a former Ohio Superintendent of Public Instruction and co-author of a new book. It's titled The Buying and Selling of American Education, Reimagining a System of Schools for All Children. If you have something on your wish list when it comes to education, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the challenges of reimagining American education systems. My guest is former state superintendent of public instruction in Ohio, Susan Zelman. She served as superintendent from 1998 to 2008, a long term by today's measurements. Her new book, co-written with Margaret Sorensen, is titled The Buying and Selling of American Education, Reimagining a System of Schools for All Children. You know, you were talking about getting everybody kind of in the room, sort of a thing, to talk about this stuff, and that people have great ideas, and it's really exciting when people are free to share them and talk about it. But one thing I've noticed about the education system is that its inhabitants, that is the children, the students, and their parents, are largely transient in the process. So outside of the taxes they pay, their direct involvement under the best of circumstances lasts just 12 years, you know, 12 or so years, depending on how many kids they have, right?
Right.
How do you make this relevant beyond someone's own experience? How do you give everyday people a chance to be a stakeholder in this?
Well, first of all, everybody pays taxes.
But after a while, it's like once their kids are out, then sometimes they don't want to pay the taxes much anymore.
But I think we have a responsibility to really think about how do we educate and cultivate the next generation, you know, and to think about, you know, what do we want to pass on to the next generation? What kinds of wings and skills will they need to follow in our footsteps? And, you know, education has many purposes. It's an important socializing agent to maintain our democracy. It's important for our future. I mean, one way of general public could think about it is, okay, who's going to take care of us in our old age? And we want a viable workforce so that there'll be money for and a prominent economy so that there'll be money to take care of us. And, you know, and I always think that teachers in their classrooms have the future doctor, lawyers, and Indian chiefs, and God knows what in a new changing technological world. And they're important human resource developers. And we also need it for national defense. You know, I mean, I was lucky enough to visit other countries, China, India, China in particular, take their education system very, very seriously. And other countries have made incredible progress. I mean, we're not doing great on the international assessments. And other countries, particularly Western European countries, are doing better than
I'm curious about your thoughts about how concentrated those countries are versus the sprawling United States and the 50 states and all the different, you know, iterations of those states.
Well, that's true. But they also have marginalized people. They also have diversity. And they have a very different type of system. They have basically a pluralistic system, a system that funds private, public and parochial schools. And they don't have teacher shortages. They make a greater investment in their teachers than we do.
In other words, they pay them more.
That's right. They pay them more, but they also train them better. And in fact, I just gave a talk last week about how we can improve teacher education in the state of Ohio, and we could look at best practices of other countries. And teaching in other countries is a more valued and honored profession. It's taken seriously. You know, and American culture is a bit anti-intellectual. So, we really care about our football. But that's an issue. But I think we have a moral responsibility. I mean, the general public has a moral responsibility to think of what is it going to be like for whether they have children or not. What is it going to be like for the next generation?
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with former Ohio Superintendent of Public Instruction from 1998 to 2008, Susan Zelman. Her new book is titled The Buying and Selling of American Education, Reimagining a System of Schools for All Children. What is your fantasy out there, listeners? Well, how would you like to see education reimagined? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. During your tenure, you helped roll out different iterations of school choice in Ohio. There's the voucher program, then there's the charter schools. Tell me about how that figures into your larger vision.
Well, first of all, I think that all parents need better choices for their children. I mean, I had three children. They're very, very different. And yet I sent them to one public school. And for one of them, it worked well. For two, not so well. And in my vision of what is possible, parents should have better choices. And if you look at Western European countries, you know, you can go to a religious school or a private school funded by other public money. However, unlike I think our choice programs, there are better choices because it's better quality, because it is regulated by the government, and there's strong accountability.
The premise when I was covering the emergence of charter schools, the premise was take away the shackles, unshackle them from all the rules, let them experiment, let them show what blah 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 can do without all of the rules and regulations. I think always that kind of woof and warp, you know, between regulation and let them just do what they do.
Well, I mean, a lot of people, and particularly my board members, believed in market-based economies and that parents would walk with their feet. But the reality is doing school is really hard and complicated work. And that we need to, and that's part of my concern with the backpack bill.
The money follows the child.
I think the money following the child is a great idea, particularly you know, if I were queen of the world, I would have different weights for different types of kids with different types of problems like we do in special education, mm-hmm. and merge both education funding with health and human service funding and so forth. And I think in an age of new technology, we could do that better. But we need to, parents need to have good quality choices. Now, that's not to say that there aren't some good models that came out nationally of the charter school movement. But there's been a lot of monkey business and corruption, even in our state. And what I don't like about the backpack bill in other states like Florida or Arizona, one is that there's no empirical evidence to show that it works. And we need, if you're going to do something like that, you better do some research and evaluation. Second is that you don't, there's no accountability to where the money goes to. And even in our voucher program, and of course I'm the Zelman of the first voucher case, mm-hmm. of the Supreme Court, we need more accountability so that, you know, private schools who accept or religious schools who accept vouchers should test all their kids so that parents can make a better choice of where they go and they have the data in front of them. So I'm advocating for what I call accountable pluralism. I'm a supporter of school choice, but it has to be high quality.
I want to take Chris real quick here. Chris from Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Go ahead.
Sure. So as I've been listening to the interview, I haven't heard a lot about universities. And so I'm curious, what can the role of universities be in addressing all the issues in the school system? And since she's been state superintendent, has she seen universities become more or less engaged in those sorts of things and teacher training and addressing those disparities?
Well, I think, historically, our universities were in some ways very much engaged. But my role, my vision is that universities come to the table and have a stronger role. Universities used to have lab schools. Universities, from my perspective, have not created a vision of possibilities. Universities are somewhat narrow or have a political philosophies.
Well, they teach teachers to teach in the status quo way.
Right. I think there should be more experimentation, okay. More research and development, more testing about what is possible. And they should come to the table with business and with government and think about creative ways of meeting the needs of all kids. And also, universities have a lot of other resources. Education shouldn't be siloed because education is really like the microcosm of society. And education is affected by political systems, economic systems, health systems, legal systems. And the universities can play a wonderful role using all of its resources to rethink a better system of education, including training of teachers.
Where do they fit into the buying and selling of American education?
Well, universities certainly have a strong interest in K-12 education, particularly at a time of declining enrollments. One is that they want students to be able to go on to college, though college might not be for everybody. Mm-hmm. And also, they don't want to pay money for remediation. So they have a strong, strong interest in having a high-quality pre-K to 12 system.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Michael in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how's it going today?
Good, thank you.
Good. So I kind of jumped in a little bit in the middle, so I apologize if you guys talked about this. I was in Germany in 2006, and the family I stayed with, they talked through different types of graduation as far as like you can graduate in 9th grade, 10th grade, or 13th grade, depending on the track that you wanted to pursue after high school. And I just thought that was interesting, and it focused more on like what you were interested in at that time. So if there was trades that you're interested in, if there was a job that you're interested, or if you were looking to go to university or something in that capacity, I thought that was interesting. And just wanted to get your thoughts on that, how that plays into the system now. I liked your talk about pluralism and trying to understand how that fits into our current system. So.
Well, first of all, in America, I think we have something called the culture of low expectations. And we have a lot of hidden bias. So what happens in our tracking systems is that minorities or people that teachers feel are not capable go into the lowest track. And then if they want to go to a two-year community college or take an apprenticeship or whatever, they don't have the skills and the abilities they need to be successful. I'm working right now in Appalachia, and I'm working with Workforce Development Board 15, and I work for a non-for-profit, been around for 35 years, called Jason Learning. Some of you might remember it as the Jason Project. The guy who started it discovered the Titanic. And what we're doing now, which I think has implications for a bill which the legislature is considering, is we're taking our academic content standards and replacing some modules, which will give kids an understanding of the workforce. So, for example, if you're in a high school course and you're learning about thermodynamics, you could really learn those principles, also understanding HVAC. If you're in a lab in a high school or a middle school course and you're learning about health safety, we also connect it to OSHA certification in safety in manufacturing. So we're embedding workforce development concepts into what we call localized community. And we have been working with the Appalachian Manufacturing Association to do that for manufacturing units. And in all of our work, we use local role models. So people from the community come in and talk about their work that the students are studying in this module, so they could see real life connections as well as a local role model.
Where is this based?
This isn't based. We work in four counties.
Okay.
Noble County, Marietta County, Morgan County, and God.
Okay, so those are some pretty remote counties.
Right.
So I wanted to ask about that because just from covering Appalachia for, you know, like I did many years ago, there are some extremely poor areas where the most prominent local person is the teacher.
Exactly. Exactly. And also,
there are no lawyers. There are no doctors.
Well,
there are no factory managers.
Well, not enough. And also, we've had tremendous success because I've also worked in West Virginia. West Virginia, for example, was for the first time ever getting internet services. So we developed a core. And what I also love about this non-for-profit is that we give what we develop to the community. So we give it to the Boys and Girls Clubs. We give it to Boy Scouts, 4-H. We also work together. We bring in the community and the students to solve a community problem. So, for example, what came out of our project in Appalachia was a help desk run by high school seniors who and supported by the internet provider of that community to help people like me or the elderly to learn how to use the internet.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you have a question or comment, want to share your idea about how to improve education in the United States. My guest is Susan Zelman. She is former Ohio Superintendent of Public Instruction, and her new book, which she co-authored, is titled The Buying and Selling of American Education, Reimagining a System of Schools for All Children. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the challenges of remaking American education systems. My guest is former state superintendent of public instruction in Ohio, Susan Zelman. Her new book, co-written with Margaret Sorensen, is titled The Buying and Selling of American Education, Reimagining a System of Schools for All Children. What is your what's your question about this? What do you think? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. A big issue that's popped up a few times over the last three decades that I've been covering it is the extent to which values, morals, and other such intangibles, I think of them as, should be taught in public schools. The culture wars of the moment are playing out every day in our schools over issues such as gender identity, the history of racism, and the Sneetches, right, of all things, which was my favorite childhood book growing up. I must have read it 5,000 times. Okay. So what, I mean, how do you get past all of that? And you've, as you made note, this isn't the first time, and it won't be the last.
I feel we're a democracy, right? And we only have one public school. I mean, one system, essentially, in all 50 of our states. And I think when you have one school, you know, it's very hard for a school to be all things to all people. And so I think that helps to create these types of culture wars. But I also think the signal of culture wars should signal to educators that we have a diversity in our community. And why you, the superintendent, might have a sense of what you're doing and what you are doing is good for kids, which is probably true. You also need to survey constantly and communicate constantly with your parents so they'll build that particular trust. Plus, I feel we need to do a better job of helping teachers deal with and training teachers, because I was a teacher trainer at one time. We used to talk about training of teachers with regard to controversial issues in the classroom and how you deal with it and concerns. And not everybody agrees with it. I mean, I certainly went through the culture wars as a state superintendent, you know, and I'm here for 1 month. And my mother calls. I have to go out to a meeting. My mother's elderly. I'm thinking, oh, my God, what's going on with my mother? And she says to me, how did I bring you up? I said, what are you talking about? She said, I just went to lunch, and she was in senior housing, with my friends. And they said they heard about you on a talk show, Laura Schlesinger's talk show, and that you were advocating putting condoms or teaching kids about how to put condoms on. So I assured my mother that was not my position, and so forth. Or, I mean, I went through intelligent design. And, you know, we had tens of board meetings from the left and from the right. And then I looked at my board and I said, you know, this could be a great opportunity for kids. I mean, I go to synagogue. I'm a practicing Jew. My children go to church, synagogue, mass, or whatever. They go into a science class. They learn about the processes of science. And why not use this as a great opportunity to think about different ways of knowing? You know, we have belief, and we have the epistemology of science. And couldn't we, in our classes, explain those differences in a way that will make everybody happy? And of course, there was emails going around Columbus. Oh, we have a Jewish superintendent who believes in intelligent design. So, I mean, you know, it always happens. But I think we need to find creative solutions. I mean, kids need to feel secure and safe in the presence of their teachers to ask any question. And teachers must address those questions in an intellectually honest way. And even if a student asks you, well, what do you believe? you know, I think you could tell them what they believe, but let them know, I came to this through a process, but now it's your turn to figure out what you believe and what you want.
James in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, James.
Hi there. You kind of touched on the point I was going to ask, which was about creating safety and safe spaces for LGBTQ youth in schools. And I appreciated your discussion on it, but I was wondering how you might discuss the idea of you talked about creating trust with parents and collaborative solutions, but how do you deal with that when parents are completely unwilling to compromise on any of that and even choose to, like, homeschool their children? We just had a scandal erupt about a homeschool group that was all Nazi stuff. So how do you deal with that situation?
Well, first of all, I'm sort of an optimist. And I believe that coming together and discussing issues will allow us to find our common humanity. So for example, I think it's a tragedy that Florida is not going to let an AP course
on African American studies,
because it's about African American art, history, music. And it's a way of us understanding that we're all part of the human race and that we all have concerns and values. And I believe in inclusion and multiculturalism, particularly because the world is becoming that way. We're becoming a smaller world, and we need to accept people's strengths and learn from them.
James, thanks for that question. Catherine in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I appreciate Ms. Selman's desire to see accountability with regard to private and charter schools. She may have already said this, but I would add that it feels critical that there is statewide consistency and accountability around curriculum as well. One of the historical purposes of the Common School, I'm guessing she covers in her book, was to bring people together of different cultures and backgrounds, coming to a shared understanding of the world through the various subjects and, you know, finding a way forward together. And I'm concerned that without that common curriculum, you know, the money follows the child is going to create more division. You know, we see how people have different sets of what they believe is reality, and it's sort of driving more divisiveness in our country. The other piece I wanted to add was wondering how Ms. Zellman feels about funding for public schools currently. You know, understanding that parents want to take their kids to the schools that are best fit for them, but the fact that we have yet to adequately fund our public schools, you know, it concerns me that money is going away from those public schools. They're never really getting that chance to be the fully funded resource that you would want to have in your neighborhood, that your kids can walk down the street to. So I'm curious, you know, what her thoughts are on that as well.
Well, those are two really very good issues. One, I will tell you, I think the public schools are under-resourced. Even though it's like the third largest in our state budget, we need a stronger federal investment in education as well as a stronger state investment. Also, there's great variability within the state of Ohio about how the resources that schools have, given the fact we have a property tax. And I would say
about almost half. Well, about 44% comes from local taxes.
Right, 44% does come from local dollars. Right, so, I mean, again, I think we are under-resourced and we need a better infusion. However, with regard to what your first part of your question, I think in some ways you've articulated which I would call the myth of the common school. The reality is we have housing policies, banking policies, which create neighborhoods of poor people and rich suburban people. And we don't really have that diversity that we want. And in other countries, that what they do is they fund religious schools, private schools, and public schools based upon a common, a core set of values and a curriculum, and they inspect or hold accountable all the schools because they have public funds. And in some ways, they, one, don't have, they don't have teacher shortages, and they don't have this perpetual issues of culture wars, which takes our focus off what are the needs of children.
Catherine, thanks for that call. One more from Joe in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Joe.
Hey, hi. Hi to both of you. The author just talked about what other countries do or other parts of the world do with regard to education. I grew up in Guernsey County, Appalachia, Ohio, 7077. Right. I do know the Battelle here in Columbus has done research and sent people to Indonesia to understand and to study why their educational system is good, very good. And if you think about it, we have a lot of relationships, historical ones, former governors with ambassadors and so forth, with Germany. Germany's a powerhouse because they have a two-track educational system. You start out in school, your teachers monitor what your strengths and weaknesses are, and they tend to guide you either into an apprenticeship program with Mercedes or BMW or a similar company, or you go the academic track. That's really all I have to say. And the other thing is the desire to learn comes your family environment. Your parents have to instill in you, or at least make you aware of, the cause and effect relationship between learning something and understanding slash doing something.
So I'm glad you said that. I just want to ask Susan Zellman, if you don't have that family backdrop, are you?
Well, I think that's one of our myths. I think that, it's very hard for a family who's struggling to pay the rent, to raise kids, to work two or three jobs. You know, other countries have better, I would argue, other countries have better safety nets than we do, which allows them to focus more on their kids' education. Plus, I think when you have a system of choice, which I think the choice people should include in their argument for choice, is that it gives parents an opportunity to think about what do they want for their kids? What's the best match for my kid and my values and what I aspire them to become? So I think that's really important as well. And in Germany, quite frankly, their tracking system has a lot of flexibility. To work in Mercedes requires a lot of technical skill and knowledge. And if they decide they want to become an engineer, either the business pays for it or they can go on to the university themselves.
They're not stuck.
And they're not stuck. They're not stuck in a track. And I know I've reinvented myself in my career many times, and I hope I could, God willing, I could still reinvent myself. And I think that will be the wave of the future. So what's really important is that we give the kids the skills, the abilities, the dispositions they need to create their purpose and to understand their purpose, and that they will be able to be successful no matter what track they choose.
Yeah, you do. I mean, we're just about out of time, but I'm curious. You do mention lifelong learning, that we think that this is some kind of linear thing with a start and a stop date.
And it's not true. I mean, in this very rapidly changing world, we have to be agile and flexible and understand how we must always continue to learn.
Susan Zellman's former Ohio Superintendent of Public Instruction from 1998 to 2008. She's co-author of a new book. It's titled The Buying and Selling of American Education, Reimagining a System of Schools for All Children. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's it for now. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.